Good morning. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
2 minutes?
2 minutes, please.
You may proceed.
All right. Good morning. I'm Robin Phillips. I'm here on behalf of the appellant. There are a few issues before you today, and I'd like to address them without going through a recitation of the facts. This is an appeal from a decision on a partial motion for summary judgment. And the first issue is, or involves, a cut in pay in 2013. This is a case where my client ran into serious financial difficulties in running of her business. And in 2013, she went to the appellants and said, the respondents and said, I need to cut your pay effective mid-March. In April, she sent out an email that confirmed some previous deferred income, but in that email said nothing about this cut in pay. And the trial court made a determination without looking at those facts most in our favor and determined that, in fact, there wasn't sufficient evidence to create a material issue of fact. And I want to point out to you that if you take the facts in the light most favorable to us, there was sworn testimony from my client in a declaration that said, I told them I was going to cut their pay. It was not a deferment. It was a cut in pay.
When the trial court said there's no evidence of wage salary change, was that a suggestion that the court was concerned that the statement by your client that there would be a change hadn't been implemented or that it wasn't adequately documented? I mean, why did the trial court say what hard to believe the court was just flat out rejecting the declaration?
I don't know. I think the court inappropriately made credibility decisions that are for the trier of fact. Because there is no inconsistencies in what my client has ever said. So my client entered his sworn testimony that she said she told them it was going to be a cut in pay. And for some reason, the trial court disregarded the declaration and that information. There was also evidence to suggest there was a cut in pay. For instance, the email that they point to, the April 8th email, talks about deferral of 2012 income, talks about deferral of commissions, but makes no mention of the 2013. Now, had it been a deferral, it would have been included in that email, but it was not because it was a cut in pay. Additionally, the respondents offer no evidence that it wasn't a cut in pay. So, for instance, there isn't any documentary evidence from the respondent saying, oh, no, we object, you didn't include in this email the deferral of our 2013. And so we were entitled to an assumption that the declaration be taken as truthful, that there wasn't any documentation proving the negative, which was there wasn't anything that was provided that said, oh, this was a temporary deferment as well. There was no evidence to that as well. And so from our point of view, I don't know why the trial court didn't consider the information in the declaration or the trial court made a decision that it was not credible, but those decisions are for the trier of fact and not for the trial court. So that's the first issue that I'm concerned with on appeal. The second is the trial court's decision to exclude the declaration of Ms. Valenzano. Now, Ms. Valenzano stands in the position of being the current person at the business in charge of the accounts. She does payroll, accounts payable, accounts receivable. She does it. She prepared a declaration that went on and stated so many facts about how these commissions should be calculated. Her position at the time she signed the declaration was the position where it was part of her job to determine what commissions were due. That's what she did. And so her declaration contains statements of fact like, and I'll give you an example, that the respondents were double paid. For some reason, they were paid during the same period twice, once as independent contractors, once as employees. That's a statement of fact. That's not an opinion.
But
that's,
isn't it a statement of fact that depends on an expertise in auditing accounting records?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that a layperson could look at payroll records and simply say, oh, there's two entries for this. One is for an independent contractor, and one is for an employee. I think that in that declaration, it is based upon her position as a payroll accounts payable accountant for the firm. And what I can tell you is that these are declarations that are typically, or testimony that's typically offered at trial. Not every time do you have a commission issue, let's say. There's a wage and hour claim for a commission issue. Are the plaintiffs or defendants required to go out and get expert forensic testimony to show how much commissions, how they were calculated and what is due? That's certainly something that is typically and can be done in-house. And so this in-house person was the one that came forward and explained how the commissions were calculated. Now,
but had the previous includes an analysis of what gross margin means in this setting, in this application, and what's her background? She's an analytical chemist.
She's the individual at the employer making those decisions. I don't know how to say it any other way. She's a fact witness. She's an individual that's working for the employer, that's making decisions and calculating how much commission is owed. She is the witness that's doing that. She is the witness that says, when I did it, this is how I calculated commissions. I looked for expenses. I subtracted the expenses. And she has the right to explain her methodology and how she calculates commissions on behalf of the employer, which is exactly what she did in her declaration. So first, I don't think that the declaration contained anything more than things that she has personal knowledge of. And secondly, I think that it's not something that requires that skill and level that rises to an ER 702 issue. I think that 701 applies if you believe that there's lay opinion in her declaration, and certainly she had enough information, enough knowledge to at least clarify some of the issues, which are things like what commission number applies. Is it 18% or 25%? I mean, those types of questions, certainly an in-house accountant, the person that's in charge of calculating commissions, can put in a declaration. Now, having said that, I think it was reversible error for the trial court to completely disregard the declaration. It wasn't a question of whether there were portions that were admitted, portions that were stricken. It wasn't a question of whether she just weighed the value of that declaration when making her decision. The decision was to strike all of the testimony, all the exhibits, the entire declaration, which I think was error. Very briefly, with respect to exemplary damages, I believe that there is a bona fide dispute, and there has been a bona fide dispute since the very beginning as to what commissions were owed and whether or not, for instance, there was a cut in pay or a deferral of the 2013 income. So if there is a bona fide dispute, no exemplary damages attach. And so we are also asking the court to look at her decision with respect to exemplary damages. Very quickly, prejudgment interest. If there is a deferment of the 2012 commission, it is inappropriate to go back to when the amount of money was first due and count prejudgment interest during the deferral period. Certainly, that should be counted from demand on.
You'll have 2 minutes to move on.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Jack Lovejoy of Cable, Langenbach, Knurk & Bauer, on behalf of the respondents, Robert Rule and Patricia Peterson. Your Honors, to bring a little clarity, there were initially three buckets of non-paid wages at issue in this case. There was 2012 salary, 2012 commissions, and 2013 salary. The trial court found that the 2012 salary that went unpaid was unpaid willfully and awarded double damages, and that has not been appealed. Those findings and that award are verities on appeal.
How about the 2013 wage cut? Why wasn't the declaration of the owner sufficient to say, I told him effective March 16th, 20% cut. I told the bookkeeper to make that happen. Apparently it did happen. Why doesn't that create a question of fact?
I look closely at the declaration, and what it says is hearsay. It's, here I am, Michelle Gatti, out of court.
A speaking agent for the employer.
But it is an out-of-court statement by a witness. It's not a business record. It's, go ahead.
Aren't they words of legal significance? Isn't it like saying, I accept your offer, isn't an employer saying I'm changing the terms of your employment? Why isn't that outside the hearsay purview?
Because I'm not aware of which exception that would fall under. If you are a business and you want to prove that some activity in the course of your business has occurred, you have a hearsay exception that can help you with that. It is the business records rule. There is no business record regarding this claimed activity or claimed action by the company. All you have is somebody coming into court in opposition to a motion for summary judgment and saying for the first time, no, I said something way back when, and I want to rely on that out-of-court statement to prove the truth of the matter that I am now claiming.
So if you only orally accept an offer, a contract offer, you don't have a written record you can use as a business record, you can't prove that you've accepted that because that's hearsay?
Well, I don't believe that what you have here is an oral contract. You don't have any testimony from Ms. Gaddy saying, I said this, and Patricia said, okay, and then Patricia or Robert came to me later and said, yeah, Robert says okay, too. All you have is Ms. Gaddy saying,
I'm changing the terms of your employment.
All you have in the record is Ms. Gaddy saying a year and a half ago or a year ago, I said at one point, I'm going to make this change.
Okay. Apart from the hearsay argument, what other, you make arguments about inconsistency, but isn't all the case law about inconsistency not allowing a person in a declaration to contradict a prior statement in a deposition or an interrogatory answer? No case law I'm aware of that says you can't make a statement in an answer and then later contradict it in a declaration.
And we also have the employee earnings records that are in the clerk's papers, I believe pages 535, where you have the record showing that throughout the course of 2013, there was a single rate of pay for these employees.
Did that go to credibility, argument for the fact finder?
Well, no, I don't believe so, because on the one hand, you have admissible evidence, and on the other hand, you don't have admissible evidence. And so the judge was right that in this circumstance, there is no reason to delay the payment of wages to Mr. Rule and Ms. Peterson any further, because the evidence suggests that what happened is there was non-payment of wages in 2012, and then it gets admitted in April of 2013, and then the company returns to non-payment of parts of the wages. And that's one point that I want to bring some clarity to, because I think it gets very muddied up in the appellant's brief. They say in their brief, well, we instituted this, and then the April 12 emails come out several pay periods later, and they don't say anything about any wage deferral for 2013, so therefore it must not have happened. But that timing is wrong. The email about the withholding of wages in 2012, actually there are four emails. The first two, which are about 2012 salary, they are sent on April 8, 2013. The next two, which are about 2012 commissions, are sent on April 12, 2013. And then it is not until the April 19th paychecks to Rule and Peterson that the 2013 non-payment of salary begins. And there's been argument in this case, well, they kept working, and so that's consent. What they did is they sued. Less than 8 weeks later, they served the lawsuit on June 18th of 2013, and then they're promptly fired 2 days later. Your Honor, have I answered your questions about 2013 wages? Or because I can address the other parts of the case, but I don't want to leave your questions unanswered.
I don't have any other questions about that.
Thank you.
As to Ms. Valenzano's declaration,
yes.
From my understanding, there was a concession. She was not testifying as an expert. She was not a forensic accountant. But should the entire declaration have been stricken? Did she have knowledge and experience that allowed a foundation for some of the testimony in the declaration?
No, Your Honor. I think that the trial court was correct to not credit the testimony of Ms. Valenzano at all.
Well, that isn't the question, because that's a credibility determination. The question is
to not consider. I'm not trying to play with what the trial court did. Your Honor, everything that Ms. Valenzano does in her declaration that's of any significance, she talks about her personal background, and that's all fine, but everything that actually deals with how much were these people paid and how much should they have been paid is...
Was that her job? Was she responsible for payroll and determining commissions?
Not at the time that the withholding of wages happened, not at any time that Rule and Peterson were actually employed at the company, not until after Rule and Peterson had filed the lawsuit did Ms. Valenzano come and begin working in this role for the company. And what the evidence that we have about what she does for the company is solely from her declaration. But the point that I want to make about whether or not it should have been considered is she goes through and says, I looked at all kinds of records, spreadsheets, payroll records, project-specific records, and based on my review of all of those records, I think that Chinkovich's conclusions were wrong, and here are my conclusions. Well, Your Honor, a layperson cannot tell a court, trust me, there are documents that really support me, but I'm not going to show them to you. I just want you to take my word for it. It's a violation of the best evidence rule. That's why we have the best evidence rule. If she wants to say that there are documents in Project Core's records that document some expenses that should have been considered, or if she wants to say that there are documents in Project Core's records that say actually more time was spent on this project, she needs to show us the records. And their only response to that in their reply is, well, we get in under the voluminous records exception, which says that she can just summarize. No, that does not work, because under ER 1006, the voluminous records rule, you need to make those records available to the other side, and they never did. So all that Ms. Valenzano's declaration is, in substance, is her hearsay recount of what she says appears in some records and should have been considered. But that is worthless if nobody else gets to see the records. So Judge Lindy was correct to not consider that testimony.
One final question.
Please.
As to the knowingly submitted arguments as to the commissions, do we have an adequate record to really clarify whether this was a deferment until profitable or termination, whichever comes first?
Please review. The only evidence they offer is the declaration of Ms. Gaddy. Please review pages, clerk's papers, 272 and 273. The only thing she says there was an agreement to defer about is 2012 salary. Nowhere in those pages will you see the word commission come up. The 2012 salary, they haven't even appealed. Thank you.
Okay. With respect to Ms. Valenzano's declaration, I think that there are a number of things in there that are simply factual that the court should have considered. For instance, there is no dispute that the commission schedule provided that all team members participate in commission. Ms. Valenzano looked at the documents and said, no other team members except the respondents ever got paid commission.
For new projects or ongoing projects?
For both. For both. And certainly Ms. Gaddy never got paid any commission under the commission plans. So, I mean, there are certain parts of her declaration that are, frankly, I could do. I could look and see whether or not someone got paid a commission. With respect to the documents, I'd like to point out that the summary judgment was filed months before the discovery cutoff. Had there been a request for the underlying documents, they would have been provided. Counsel certainly had that opportunity if he wanted the underlying documents to get them. Also, with respect to the 2013 cut and pay, Your Honor, an employer has the right to prospectively change an employee's rate of pay whenever they want to. They don't have to get the employee's agreement to a raise or a pay cut or a change in medical benefits or anything like that. So it is more than sufficient for Ms. Gaddy to come forward and say, going forward, I don't have the money. I'm going to have to reduce your pay.
But that doesn't address the commissions, or does it?
No, I'm talking just about the 2013 cut and pay. And with respect to the exemplary damages, I believe that they did, in fact, if you look at the record, agree to willfully, they agreed to the deferment. That was a knowing submission to agree to that deferment. And so any allocation of exemplary damages or prejudgment interest for that time period is inappropriate.
Thank you, Counsel.